Hello, and welcome to episode 52 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Although the worst of the pandemic seems to be behind us, most people agree that remote work, at least for many employees, is here to stay. Here are a few findings from a recent study by Owl Labs. Remote employees save an average of 40 minutes each day on commuting. 23% of those surveyed would take a 10% pay cut to work from home permanently. And the survey also found that 59% of respondents said they would be more likely to choose an employer who offered remote work compared to those who didn't. Rick, I can think of few things that will change our jobs as much as this work-from-home revolution. Do you think this is a good thing for both employees and employers, or not?
Yeah, overall, I think it's good. And one of the reasons is we're going to be seeing many more hybrid work environments as a result. And what happened during the course of the pandemic, it happened right before our eyes, the technology for remote meetings got so much better.
Well, okay, and there's never, we can all agree, never a great time to have a pandemic, but can you imagine if this pandemic would have happened 10, 15 years earlier? It would have been entirely different.
Well, yeah, it would have been entirely different because we didn't have, I think 10 years ago, maybe we had Skype, something like that.
The infrastructure and a lot of even the high-speed internet, not that it's perfect now, but was much less built out than it is today.
Yeah, we still have substantial parts of the country that don't have adequate broadband or don't have any broadband at all. But at least in cities, in many suburban areas, there's adequate internet speed to support many of these kinds of work environments and the sorts of meetings that teams at least have to have to be able to work well together.
And we all remember when people like me and others were sent home from offices to work at home, there was certainly the realization that this was a smart thing to do because of an unknown virus, but there were also a lot of questions about productivity and if this was going to work even in the short term. And there's been a lot of studies, and I think most of those studies have proven that in most cases it works pretty well.
Yeah, it's interesting that employees that are what some people call remote capable, that is where it's possible for them to do remote work. It's probably estimated maybe about 50% of the American mm-hmm. workforce fits into that category. Prior to the pandemic, only about 40% of them were working remotely, and most of those were doing part-time remote work. And now it's about 75% of them. So that's been a huge shift. And so we're seeing a shift take place, and in many cases, it's because that's what the workers prefer.
It's what the workers prefer, but I think, too, that if the work wasn't getting done in any significant way, there would have been a huge and quick rush back to the office because the people writing the paychecks would have said that this is just nothing that's going to work much longer than a month or two or three.
Yeah, and I think what companies have found, some of them have found that productivity's gone up. Others find it's gone down. It depends so much on the type of work that's being done.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, some kinds of jobs are remote capable. Some are, remote capable with some qualifications. There's a lot of people that are working pretty much independently, and it's very easy for them to do their work remotely. And others are doing works in small teams where they're regularly, interacting with others, but not in ways that requires them to be face-to-face. So say if you're doing work that's largely computer-based and then consulting with teams on projects, remote meetings are oftentimes more productive because you can have two monitors. You can have your meeting on one screen or just on audio lots of times, and you can have your data in front of you, and you can be talking about what's going on that spreadsheet. This is one of the things I find a little bit frustrating about this conversation is we talk a lot about what's better, remote or not, or in-person work, but there's so many other factors. And one of the big one is, what is the type of work?
Well, I think that's one of the type of the work is, but I would also say, and you mentioned hybrid is becoming a more common thing. And for some people, that maybe means 3 days in the office, 2 days at home. For some people, that means 1 day or 2 days a month in the office and the rest at home. It really varies. But I think smart employers, at least, are beginning to realize that the type of work that needs to get done when you're gathering people together in a room is very different than it had been in what I'll say the modern office has been for the last half century, where we just created these modern workplaces, in post-World War II, I suppose, where you had all these offices where you had but no choice is to bring people in and kind of create this office culture that a lot of people were working very independently, but they were all in small offices or in individual cubes, and they were just there doing their work. And occasionally you'd bring everybody together in a room to collaborate on a project. But there wasn't a lot of thought about what makes the most sense. And I think smart companies now can say, okay, if you're working on a project where you need some deep concentration and you aren't really interacting with people very often at all, you know, just go home and do that. But if we're going to get together and plan out our strategy for the next 6 months and we want input from everybody, maybe sitting around a table is a good way to make sure everybody's voices get heard. And I just don't think those were conversations that had been happening in the office culture, if you will, for really up until recently.
Yeah, I think one of the things that happened with the pandemic is it forced organizations to deal with certain kinds of stresses that had been building for a long time. One of those stresses is the changing nature of work within the organization. So you had all kinds of people that were showing up at offices and cubicles and so forth who were, for the most part, working independently anyway.
Yeah.
So they're in a building with a lot of other people, but they're at their desk, they're on a computer looking at a monitor, and then they're eating lunch, for example, at their desk in front of their computer screen. And you know, if that's what's going on, that creates a certain kind of stress. And then why require people to come in if there's not a meaningful interaction on a regular basis anyway? And in workplaces, we're struggling to figure out how to deal with all of this. And then the pandemic kind of forced many organizations to experiment with a lot of different methods of interaction. And we're still trying to figure out like what works and what doesn't and what should we do about it.
Well, and I remember as you're talking about that, probably 15 years ago when I was a manager in a newspaper newsroom, there was a reporter who was a younger reporter who was working on a big project. And I think she had done all her reporting, talked to all the people she needed to talk to. She was just going to spend much of the day writing. And she approached me and says, you know, newsrooms can kind of be chaotic places. Would it be okay if I just grabbed my laptop and went home to work? And I'll admit, I was not a very forward-thinking manager at that exact moment because I said, well, no, I mean, we just need you to stay here. And I mean, there wasn't a reason why. It's other than like that's just how we do things. Of course, you're writing your story and we have a newsroom. Where else would you go? And now, like in today's world, that just seems like the wrong decision for all the obvious reasons. But I'm sure she just was like, well, you're the boss. Fine, I'll sit here and write the story. And I'm sure she did. And I'm sure it turned out fine. But in retrospect, I can't tell you why I felt that way other than, well, that's how we always do it. And that's not good.
Yeah, I remember having a similar kind of experience as a young professor at a college where our department chair expected us all to be available all the time, you know, for our office hours and then different times for meetings, and kind of available at the drop of the hat for different kinds of collaboration. But here I'm a younger person, and I'm using email communications much more, and I'm collaborating on some projects with colleagues from around the country. And this is something that really hadn't been possible before. You have to had to do it by going traveling,
yep,
you know, to work with them, or by snail mail. But now we can share documents by email and edit each other's work. And so I'm doing a kind of work that he had no idea what was going on, because this was a new technology at the time, right? Yeah. And it takes a while with any kind of big change for workplaces to adapt, because of the expectations of different people that grow up at different stages with the technology. Now, one of the things that happened with the pandemic is we all experienced it together. And this usually doesn't happen. It's usually a generational change. This time it wasn't. I mean, because, you know, you had 20-year-olds and 60-year-olds learning Zoom at the same time.
That's a really good point. Yeah. And, you know, and my theory on some of this is that when this happened, and, you know, for people in my age, well into their career in their 40s, that it seemed like it was okay. I mean, I knew all these people in my workplace, and I was just interacting with them in different ways, but I knew my job well. If I had a question, I knew who to turn to. All those things, I knew. It was just the method of communication was different, but like the relationships I'd already built. And I feel a little worried about people who are new to a workplace, or maybe even more so new to the workforce, who are coming into their first professional job, maybe out of college, and their orientation, the people they meet, the way they get introduced to the company is all electronically. And I don't think that that is going to build the same kind of loyalty that employee has to the company, and maybe not the same kind of loyalty that company has to that employee if they're not someone who's there in person. And I also just worry that they're not going to develop sort of those soft skills about, oh, well, when this little problem comes up, I don't know what to do, and I don't know who to ask, and things that really you benefit from being in an office. And I was listening to a podcast about this a couple of weeks ago, and somebody drew the comparison of a new employee, and I think the analogy was to childbirth, and that when you're pregnant, you have 9 months where you're kind of have that, you know, preborn child in your womb, and you're kind of nurturing them to get ready for the world. And I think the point was that you should almost require, if at all possible, to have 9 months at least of somebody new to a workplace in the office, if there's people in an office, to kind of make those connections before sort of setting them free.
Yeah. So in that qualification, if there is an office, this is one of the problems. If you have, like many of the most significant members of a team, all working remotely, there is no place to go other than in these remote meetings or some kinds of hybrid meetings for those relationships to get formed. And I think you're exactly right. This could be to the disadvantage of new workers in an organization who haven't already established some relationships. And so then it's going to be really important for, I think, good managers to figure out how to negotiate that and create opportunities for some kind of social engagement. I know that, you know, right now, as one of the more senior members in an organization, I really don't get a good estimation of a new person's ability unless we're serving on some kind of a committee, we're doing some kind of a project together where we're meeting on a regular basis, and I get to know them in a little bit more depth than just like what are the work tasks and how do they get them done. And that's where, you know, I'll notice that somebody has, say, seems to have more potential than what they're actually demonstrating or what the task demands. And I might say something to them about them, you know, like, there might be some new opportunities or some other way they could serve the organization, and suggest that they do that, put themselves forward a little bit, or to, you know, perhaps write a letter of recommendation or serve as a reference for them. These little things are really important. And so figuring out how do we do that in these remote, kind of new remote hybrid settings is going to be a big challenge.
You know, a few minutes ago, I was talking about, you know, a theory I may have that these remote work situations may tamp down a bit on loyalty both ways, employer to employee and employee to employer. And I get the sense that maybe that's something that has been going on even before the remote work revolution, that I think we all know that people don't stay with companies as long as they used to. You get the sense that in some cases, in some companies, that there's not as much loyalty to keeping on employees, that they're looked more as commodities than people. And are you worried at all that this remote work force just makes that even worse?
Yes, because it's a continuation of something that you said has been happening for a long time. If you look at the history of a word like efficiency, it really arises in early 1900s. It takes off, you know, from 1910 to 1920. It just explodes on the scene. Hmm. The word is just used everywhere all of a sudden. And this is the time of, you know, like Taylor and, you know, these workplace efficiency studies with factories and so forth. You get Henry Ford, who reputedly said something like, why is it every time I hire a human being, it comes with, when I hire somebody, I get the whole human being, when all I want is a pair of hands, right? This idea of like, we just want people to fit in as cogs in a machine. And so these efficiency studies were ways to try to figure out how does that happen? How do we maximize the productivity from every single person? Because this is where most of our money is going into the, you know, into people's wages. That's still taking place. And we find different ways to phrase it, but we're still obsessed with productivity and efficiency. And every new development of technology is an attempt to do that. These new developments of technology are engagement destroyers. Right.
Well, and you had even pointed out the story that I think that was in this week's New York Times that sort of focuses on that way that has quickly become developed, that employers can manage and monitor the efficiency of their employees remotely. And there are some troubling things in that.
Really troubling, because just about every big company in the world, and many small companies too, are doing engagement studies. They're measuring this and they're trying to figure out, like, how do we increase engagement? And then at the same time, they're doing everything they can to destroy it.
You're saying encouraging engagement with their employees.
They're trying to encourage, they're measuring it, mm-hmm. and they're trying to improve it. At the same time, they're employing these technologies which create senses of mistrust and also undermine the meaningfulness of people's work, undermine the kind of autonomy that people have in some kind of freedom in determining how they do that work, and oftentimes undermining the relationship between employees and their supervisors. Those are the three main factors in high engagement. And so if you have like tracking technology, you know, measuring keystrokes or, you know, like cameras on people and so forth, like measuring every minute of people's work, they deeply resent it because it undermines all three of those things. It undermines your relationship with the supervisor because you're not being trusted. It takes away all of your autonomy. And it oftentimes makes you think that your work isn't meaningful. I see that. I think it's a big mistake. I think companies that are going into this kind of tracking technology without being really careful about it, are shooting themselves in the foot.
One thing that stood out at me in that New York Times story is they talked to a hospice chaplain. Now, when we're thinking about the way you measure these things, you're often thinking about maybe people who are keying in orders at their computer and how quickly they can complete the order and how accurately they can complete the order. And sort of those, what I'll call repetitive tasks. But no, not always. This was a chaplain, in a hospice program at a hospital, And he was measured, or one of the ways he was measured, is how many points of contact he had with patients throughout the day and throughout the week. And I've never been a hospice chaplain, but I would imagine that some of these conversations may take a little bit of time and some of them may take a whole lot of time. And that as someone who's done that for a while, I bet he has a pretty good sense about where to, you know, use that time. But he admitted in the story that he would intentionally go out of his way to touch base with a person who is probably sleeping or maybe not even quite cognizant, just to kind of check something off the list and made it feel like he had that touch point and moving on. And I guess I was not surprised to hear that that's what he was doing, but I was surprised, and maybe shouldn't have been, that these measurements and these tools that employers are using are really, I guess, going up the employment chain, if you will, not just simply entry-level workers, but people who really do have a great deal of soft skills or things that you would think would be tough to measure, but maybe they feel like they're not.
Yeah, so this is that's a really disturbing story, because you have people that go into something like chaplaincy because they really want to help people, and they want to help them at their most vulnerable moments, and then you implement a kind of measurement or point system that rewards points based on contact without any regard to the meaningfulness of it. And so you just destroy the person's entire motivation for doing the work in the first place. And it's no surprise that this person then ends up resigning from the job.
Yeah.
Right. And we find in jobs like this, where people have some kind of pro-social motivation for doing the work, and then they're forced to conform to these really rigid kind of measurement or accountability standards, you get really high rates of burnout. And that's not what you want, because you want to increase productivity. Well, it does in the short term, and this is why the companies that sell these devices, this technology, can say this is going to work really good. And they track it for 3 months or 6 months. You do get a productivity boost, and then you have a gradual decline and sometimes a collapse. And then what you often have is you have your very best people leaving because they just can't tolerate it anymore. So it's a really short-sighted approach. I think it can also be short-sighted with regard to people that are doing what you mentioned, like just basic, like keyed entry types of things, because everybody, no matter what their work, wants to take pride in the job that they do. When my sons worked for a while, he was an intern at a call center. And you think, well, call center, they always do this kind of tracking, you know, and how long are you on the call? Does it get resolved? What kinds of reviews do you get from the customers? That sort of thing. It's very hard to design a measurement system which is as sophisticated at making, you know, good calls, at making the right decisions, as your best employees are. And so you get a situation where your best employees are saying, well, I know I'm being measured on this, but here's a customer who really needs the help. I need to spend more time with this person. But then they get dinged for it, yeah. Right? When you punish a people for doing what they believe justifiably to be the right thing, and also to be in the best interests of the company, and you punish them for it, they become completely demoralized. And I remember having a long conversation with my son where he said, you know, our best employees keep leaving. We have these people that are really good, but then they're just devastated when they get a dock in pay or they lose their bonuses because of something that they do that they're pretty sure was the right thing. I just see companies continually making that mistake and underestimating their employees. Now, I know there are problems. There are problems with theft. There are problems with people cheating. There are problems, you know. But you can deal with these things. You can deal with the real problems without getting so fine-tuned that you micromanage your best employees. That's what you want to avoid.
Before we close on this topic, there were a remote work. There were just a few other things I wanted to touch on that where there are, I guess, what I call second order effects of this. And I think in some of these cases, there's some good things, or at least some opportunities for good things. One is we are seeing a fair amount of movement across the country where people now are able to live in many cases where they want to live or where it's more affordable to live. There, especially in, I read in the Bay Area, which is clearly an area that is more high tech than most, they are seeing a lot of outgrowth from the center of the city in San Francisco, one of our most expensive places to live. There are people who are moving sometimes an hour, sometimes 3 or 4 hours away from the city because it's cheaper. And if they only have to go in once a month or once every couple months, that's not really even like commuting. That's almost like a business trip. Now, a couple things that leads to is that you have these office buildings that are not nearly as full as they once were. But what I've heard companies are just starting to do, and I found this fascinating, is they're taking some of that extra office space and turning it into, I guess I'll call them mini hotel rooms. So if you're that guy who lives 3 or 4 hours away, who has to come into the office once a month, well, you can come into the office, but you don't have to worry about renting a hotel down the street. They'll actually have like a decent place for you to spend the night. And that's kind of a nice thing for the company because it saves them money. And maybe for you, because you don't have to worry about traffic and finding a place to park and all that stuff. So it's interesting how, you know, we're in the midst of these huge changes also in real estate, where certainly in our city, and I'm certain in most cities across this country, there is a great abundance of office space that I just can't see getting filled up anytime soon. And it'll be real interesting to see what happens to all of those, that space, because we're also in many parts of this country seeing a scarcity in housing, and it's not as simple to turn those places into apartments for plumbing and all sorts of other reasons, but it's being tried some places because there is just no demand right now for office space in many of our largest cities.
We've been seeing for some time kind of revitalization in cities and, you know, like old factories, and old, very old office buildings being turned into condominiums and apartments. I think you're going to see more of that. But instead of something being abandoned for like 20 or 30 years and then turned into apartments, I think we're going to see it much more quickly. We're going to see a quick turnaround.
Yeah, I lived in a condo building in our city that was actually built as a tobacco warehouse. And it took a long time. I think it stopped being a tobacco warehouse sometime in the 40s or 50s, and then in the 80s, they turned it into condos, and, you know, here we go. But, yeah, obviously, a tobacco warehouse and a condo have very different footprints inside, but they made it work, and I'm confident that we're going to see some of those changes because, though, and the other thing that really isn't talked about a lot is all the property. You know, if you're a landlord and you have all this empty real estate, well, your property value is going to fall, which means your property tax bill is going to fall, which means that a lot of these cities are going to depend more and more on other revenue sources when they used to be able to expect a big property tax check coming in from the owners of all these big office buildings.
And at the same time, we're seeing housing prices go up in many rural areas and small
yes.
towns. Because there are many people finding real housing bargains in those areas and are able to work remotely from them. So the remote work phenomenon is having huge shifts. And I think we're just starting to see the effects of it. It's going to be something that's going to transform our culture.
And as we've talked about on this show many times before, but as more people are retiring and fewer people right now are coming into the workforce, that is a huge recruitment tool, is to say, you know, we'll be flexible. We haven't really talked about this on the whole show, but I know someone personally who was a remote worker during the pandemic, and she was just itching to get back. She missed that connection. She missed being around people, and she was She literally was the one of the very first two or three people back in this big office building because that's just where she wanted to be. There are absolutely people like that. They're not the majority of people, I don't think, but there are people like that. So I think companies have to realize they need to attract people like her, and they also need to attract the people who are like, hey, I want to come in once a month and live 3 hours from here out in the mountains because that's where I want to raise my family. And everybody's different and everybody has different wants and needs. And I think the smart companies are going to be able to accommodate those things.
Yeah. And I think if you really listen to your employees and work with them, you can find some pretty creative solutions. And then you end up with, I think, much more loyal, but also highly engaged people that are going to do good things. And so that's an important lesson. I think we have to keep learning it over and over again in new situations. But listen to people, work with them, and figure out solutions. And it's a very exciting time to be in. I think there's so many possibilities. I feel myself in this kind of new work environment to be really energized by it, because there's possibilities for types of work and kinds of collaboration that just weren't available 10 years ago.
And hey, you can even do a podcast.
Right. Yeah. And we do some of them here in the studio and some of them remotely.
Well, I think one, we didn't even tell listeners, but you were up in the wilderness of northern Minnesota.
Recording from a camper. So there you go.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, what is your question for me?
Scott, I don't know if you've actually done this, but let's say that you take a DNA test because you're interested in finding out more about your ancestry. When you get the results back, you are surprised to find that you are a 50% match to someone about your age who lives in California. This means you have a half-brother or half-sister from one of your parents, but you have never been told about this. So what do you do? Do you keep those DNA results to yourself? Do you talk to your family members about it? Do you try to make contact with your newly discovered sibling?
To answer your first question first, I have not done this, but my sister has. And this was, of course, a sister I know about, my only sister. And she told me to not bother because we're really boring. No surprises in our background. All of the things we thought we were, we are, as far as, you know, where we came from, it wasn't very interesting. But your scenario is obviously much different, and I would say much more interesting. This is something I would probably think, this is obviously a pretty big life event. So I would probably not give it the quick bit of thought I'm giving now. But my instinctual reaction to this would be that I would probably tell my sister, because we're sort of, you know, I would make sure that there's not a secret she's been keeping from me, and we'll assume that there's not. And then I think I would want to contact this person in California. I don't think I would talk to my father about this, because I would want to do a little reconnaissance here, because I guess I'm thinking, if I'm right, that with the information I have, I would not know if this half sibling was tied to my mother or father. Would I know that?
I don't think so.
I don't think you would. So, and clearly, if it were my mother, no one can give birth and not know. Theoretically, if it were my father, there is some plausible deniability just because of how things work. So I guess I would want to try to contact this person. But of course, you don't know what this person knows either. And this person could have thought that they had a mother and father who raised them and had no reason to believe that they weren't their mother and father. And I guess you are kind of upending someone else's life. So, I don't know. I think I would still want to have that discussion. And again, I'm not a kid. I'm 50. And, you know, and I think I would want to, I would hope that this person would realize that this would not change. Would it change who their parents are? But in some ways, it would probably mean that their parents were likely dishonest with them about a pretty important thing. Yeah, I think I would still want to investigate and try to contact that person. Clearly, if that person did not want to entertain such discussions, I'll respect that and move on. But I would be way too curious to not find that person out. And if that person did want to have a conversation, I think I would want to try to put some pieces together about how this may have happened and maybe get a fuller picture of it before talking to my father.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good answer.
I don't know though. I guess I would argue that maybe the best ethical answer is to leave it all alone.
Well, I'm not sure about this. I think when you do these tests, you can indicate whether you are open to being contacted, right,
yeah,
by somebody
so.
Else or not.
So yeah, that's true.
You already know if that person would have a willingness to being contacted.
Point.
So if that's the case, then you pass the consent criteria, right?
Good point.
There's the consent. And I would think, well, if I were that other person out in California, I would be curious and would like to know.
It could be an adoption that they know all their lives that they were not the birth child of their parents. But there's obviously many scenarios that could be in play.
Yeah. It's interesting the way in which new technologies like this raise possibilities for ethical dilemmas that were never conceived before.
And right? It makes me wonder what situations we're unknowingly creating today that will be unraveled and revealed 20 or 30 years from now. It does make you wonder.
Yeah.
But what would you do if you were in that situation?
You know, it's one of the things that gives me pause is as soon as you start telling anybody, right,
mm-hmm.
you start opening the doors and make it likely that you can't control this information at all anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so even the people that you do not want to inform will find, like your father, will he find out or not? So that's the question I think I would have to ask. Would I be okay with everybody knowing this before I start trying to control, okay, I could talk to, say, my sister or my brother, but not my dad or my mom, somebody like that? I would have to say, okay, am I comfortable with everybody knowing it? Because once it gets out, it's out.
And I guess maybe for me, that my family is rather small. I mean, there's not a lot of, I mean, some people come from these huge families with, you know, hundreds of cousins and aunts and uncles, and that's just not my family. So part of me would be like, hey, it's kind of neat that all of a sudden there's this half-brother, half-sister who I've never met, and they're half a country away, and that sort of, I mean, it just seems like it could be an interesting thing. But I also know that that's maybe absolutely not how this other person views it. But then, like you said, they at least crack the door open.
And I would say, like, my actual answer to that is I would be perfectly fine with everybody in the family knowing,
mm-hmm.
just because I kind of know how they would react. There's enough scandal going back to my grandparents' years that, I don't think people would be too surprised by it.
But you're not 25.
Nope.
If you were 25, would this be a different answer? Meaning that this is, whatever this happened now, if this, you know, this happened decades and decades ago. If you're 25, this did it only happen maybe, you know, not so long ago.
I think that would be a lot different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm 60 now, so I'm at kind of at the age where I feel like there aren't that many repercussions as like far as reputation or scandal, what people think of me or for others. It's, I'm just curious.
Yeah,
you
know? That's kind of how I feel. Yeah. And you know, if the other person is not curious, well, then I guess you move on. Or you can stalk them on Facebook. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Chris Lay is Lee's podcast operation manager. Please subscribe to the Ethical Life on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rotta. Thank you for joining us.